Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt. This episode is brought to you by Racetech, Racetech Suspension and Engines. Mention Big MX Radio when grabbing some parts to bring to your local certified installer. What is it? Certified service center. That's what they are with Racetech. They're amazing. I have Racetech gold valves in my bike. I assume, Kyle, yours as well?
I think my YZ has a set of Racetech in him.
There you go. Yeah. And then that's Kyle Wolf on the line here. Photographer to the stars, or at least the ones that are in Florida right now. Kyle Wolf, welcome back to the podcast.
Great to be on again. It's been a few weeks since we did our pre-A1 show, but yeah, happy to be back on, man.
A lot has transpired. We have... we've completed seven events and we have five already.
Yeah,
because the same guy's got three of them.
Tomac, Webb, we just got Hunter, Sexton, and Kenny. Yep,
five. Kenny. Wow. This series has been incredible for the fan. Like what a treat for the fans who like show up on Saturdays and watch this, the whole thing unfold. It has been drama. It has been head scratching at times, but for my money, I would put this season at round seven mark. I'd put this series up against any series. As far as just the storylines and the ebbs and flows, and you have Chase Sexton, who aside from Anaheim 2, has not looked at all what we've come to expect out of him as a champion, as a rider who can lead laps and throw down that fastest lap time. We have not seen it aside from one particular day in Anaheim.
Yeah,
it's incredible. What are your thoughts? I could just ramble on and on, but I just this series is something truly special, and now we have another winner, a first time winner in Hunter Lawrence. Tell me about it.
No, I agree with you. I mean, as far as the series itself goes, I mean, we're only, you know, we're not even halfway through yet. We're getting close, but we're only seven rounds in. But after what was round two, San Diego, I thought, oh God, we're screwed. This series is going to be boring. I mean, Eli won the first two in convincing fashion.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it wasn't.
It was like, all, you know, Eli the last all the lap time.
Pass. Right. I mean, he dominated both those two races. I'm like, oh boy, we got peak Eli back, which is great. Like, I love the fact that Eli is back to Eli, but I thought we're in deep trouble here. It's going to be a boring year. And then it took him three more races before he won his third. All the while, we get Sexton winning one, we get Kenny winning one, we get Cooper winning the Triple Crown before Eli finally gets another win, and now we get Hunter. Like, this series, I mean, what more, who else is on the list that could maybe get a win this year? J-Coop?
And Anderson got a race win in the Triple Crown.
The Triple?
Did he not?
Yeah, Anderson, you know, like, I think once we get past Daytona this weekend, I'm hoping AP finally shows up and starts getting into the top five. But yeah, I mean, this series has been one for the books already, and we don't know what's going to happen. That's the greatest part about it.
Arguably off the page, but he would argue that probably maybe shouldn't be. But Savachi, if he rides like he did, this last weekend, Joey Savachi can win a Supercross. Absolutely, he can. I have never seen Joey Savachi race a 450 the way he did this last weekend. It was such a pleasure to watch. So much hard work. And you know that Joey believes that he can run with those guys. And this weekend he did. It was amazing to watch. What were your thoughts?
Well, I think we talked about this in the preseason show about Joey, just the way he rode in World Supercross this year when he went at it with Jason. Like, that's the confidence that I've been wanting to see out of him since he jumped to the 450 class 6 years ago, however long it's been now. He's been in that class for so long. But that's the confidence that I've been wanting to see out of him, and he's showing it. You can tell he's riding with confidence. You can tell he's analyzing as the race goes on, and he's improving. Plus, whatever they've got done to that Honda for his starts is working. I mean, the starts are 70%, 80% of the race anyway.
Yeah, he's always up front. And
he's getting it figured out, and he's not going anywhere. In fact, he's actually moving forward. I mean, I don't think there's been many races this year where he started up front and then gone backwards, save for maybe a crash. But, you know, even if he doesn't crash, he's not dropping back through the pack. He's hanging in there with those guys, and it's been great to see out of him.
It really has, and I want to see more of it. I think he can be there every single weekend, and coming into a race like this weekend, it bodes well for a guy who I think Joey's as talented indoors as he is out. And Daytona, yeah, it's very supercrossy, but you have to have motocross skills to really make that track work. He's got a great balance of both, and I'm really excited to see what he can make happen if he does in fact get some good starts again. Some extra parts finding its way onto the Honda in recent weeks. That's exciting as well for him to get that kind of support. That's good.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, and I think they've been I don't know if they've been making their way just to him or if it's been to the whole team, but you look at the other night in Dallas, I mean, Joey was what, fifth, sixth, right? And yep. Christian was ninth. I mean, two, you know, not full factory Hondas in the top 10. And Joey was mixing it up with those guys. He lost the tail at the end there, but he wasn't, you know, part of that top four conversation, but he was there. And Christian, after that bad crash he had at Seattle, fights his way into a ninth. I mean,
yeah,
those guys are like, on fire right now. And
next group, right?
Yeah. And if Shane can start piecing it together, he's been struggling more than I thought he would, honestly. But if he could just find that click, that
so
switch that he's missing,
start dependent, Shane McElroy.
It really is.
It
really is.
Everybody knows Shane can ride with these guys. He can absolutely ride with these guys. And if he can get a start, Shane McElrath can run with anybody in this sport. It's the starts have been the Achilles heel for him, honestly, throughout his 450 career, but especially lately. I'd love to see him be able to turn it around. If he can get the same starts as Joey's getting, then he can be right up there with him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any reason why at any point this year that we can't see four Hondas in the top 10, three of them being on an independent team. Like that wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. And going back to, you know, the whole start dependency thing, the one guy that I don't understand why he's not getting starts this year is Jay Coop. It just perplexes me that he can't get a start. Now he got a better than usual start. He got a top 10 start and he rode his way into a fifth, but why can't he start top five? I don't get what's going on. It's not like that. I know the bike is different compared to the 25, but it's not so vastly different that they can't get it within a percentage point close to what he had last year to get him a top five start.
Yeah. Consistently. Or even one. Like he hasn't even had a lot of heat race starts where he's out front.
He's had one heat race start this year and that's it.
Yeah. Like, very perplexing on the 32 because he has the pace.
Yeah, absolutely.
The lap time is often there. Qualifying's there.
Well, and the whoops last week, and I never, you know, they never really showed him much, so he didn't get to really, I'm sure he was jumping him, but I would have liked to have seen what his split was jumping compared to the other guys. Now, granted, they turned into jumpers for the guys ahead of him at various points of that race too, but I would like to see what his split was because he rode into fifth and he held fifth close, but I just like to have seen what the splits were and what the difference would have been had he gotten up, you know, started with those guys in the early laps.
Yeah. No, it is start cross, unfortunately, in so many ways. So starts have always been important, but when it comes to a stack field like this, who we haven't even talked about Sexton yet, or really all that much about Hunter, who won the damn thing. You can't sacrifice any amount of track position when any one of these guys could be out sprinting on lap one. Any one of these guys, if they have the clean air on lap one, can put more time on you in the first through two or three laps of any race that that we've seen live on Supercross, man. Like, you end up, if you're starting behind guys like Dylan Ferrandis, guys like Christian Craig, they're not going to just let you on through because you got a bad start. They're going to fight tooth and nail for every little bit of it. And while you're fending that off, also trying to go through this also gauntlet of superstars in the top 10, the leader is off to the races. It's where these races are won and lost. Obviously we get a couple of guys at the front who are all running that pace and they can sort it out from there, but you gotta be up at the front right at the beginning to even give yourself a chance to be a part of it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the one guy that's consistently been up there, save for maybe one race, I think that was the A2 race maybe, and it's been Kenny. And we all know how Kenny is when he gets a start, what the first five laps look like for him. He's lights out. He gets the gap. You know, even on Eli, I mean, yeah, maybe Eli runs him down at the end, and he's done it three times this year. But Kenny's the one guy that you can't give up track position to. Even if you're faster than him, if you give him five spots on the first lap, it's over for the most part.
Yeah, he kind of got swarmed there late in the race, though, eh? Like,
he really did.
He led a lot of laps here. And then
yeah,
life comes at you quick.
Once Eli passed him, it really all kind of fell apart.
Well, yeah, you just got out of rhythm too. And then like, so you shuffle that deck and then you go from being on full defense to now I got to go. That's a tough transition as well.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, just you get boxed out like that.
Yeah.
For 1 second, you can't hit the combination you want while the guy behind you can hit it because he's not the one getting pushed wide. Yeah, I mean, that makes a difference, and the whole thing just kind of fell apart for him. I was really surprised seeing Eli basically bump Cooper off the track. Like, that was kind of out of character.
A little bit of physicality between those two.
Yeah, and it wasn't dirty. It wasn't overly aggressive. I mean, it was a clean pass. I've got nothing negative as far as that pass goes. It was just weird to see him throw an elbow, you know, even just a little bit of an elbow in there and knock Coop essentially off the track, because that's where he ended up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was just, you know, back to the original point, like, this series has delivered so much in seven races. We've got 10 more to go, and we have no idea where it's going to end up. And right now, the way it's looking for this weekend in Daytona, we could have another curveball, because as of right now, the weather is saying 0.7 inches of rain on Friday and another 0.7 inches on Saturday.
Jesus. That's what this series hasn't had yet.
That's exactly what this needs.
That's exactly what 2026 Supercross need, is a mud race at Daytona. Maybe not 2008. Maybe not 2008, but can we get something in between? Like, yeah, maybe it's just something that packs the fenders up a little bit.
2012 rain would work. Yeah, 2012 rain Daytona would work. That would be.
That also just got splashy. Like, that wasn't heavy mud. That was a lot of splashy water just on the surface, sort of thing, I thought.
2012 was less rain, so it was more on the mud side. 2008 was full on just wet.
Oh, and yeah. No, that was a deluge. Like, it was like, literally, I remember watching Trey Kinnard go around this left-hand turn, and he is literally just like throttle wide open, fanning the clutch. If there's anything left, just, like, I hope I'm going the direction the track is going.
So I was there that night for that race. I was sitting up in the stands along the tri-oval, and me, my dad, my brother, my buddies were all sitting up there, and three or four different times through the night, we literally would say to each other, there is absolutely no way in hell it could rain any harder than what it is right now. And every freaking time we said that, you could see coming out of turn four of the speedway, a sheet of rain, of heavier rain coming at you, and you knew exactly when it was going to hit you. Three or four different times that shit happened, and we got soaked that night, but it was one of the best nights of racing that I'd ever been to.
Trey Kinnard wins, and I guess it would have been a sweep for Factory Connection, yep. Because Kevin Windham ends up winning the 450 main that night. Or as it was called, was that motocross and supercross, or supercross and supercross lights?
Yeah, back in that era. It was still been, yep.
Yeah, the supercross class and the supercross lights class.
Because Windham inherited the lead with two turns to go, 30 seconds after Reed's bike gave up.
Yeah.
Because he had such a
lead. I felt so bad for Reed. I think the bike just goes up in smoke.
It was like, for everybody that was there, it was kind of karma, just because he had some off-track excursions during that race that were questionable, like how he re-entered. Yeah, like you saw one of them on camera. There was another one that the camera didn't catch that, you know, it was kind of like, well, what the hell? Like he shortcutted a little bit and gained an advantage doing what he did. So it was kind of like karmatic justice right there in a way.
This is the first time hearing of this. Like 20 years later, you're incriminating the hero that is Chad Reed.
And like, I got nothing against Chad. Like, I'm a Chad fan, but just, you know, for what it is that night. And I mean, they've got one of them during the broadcast on TV where he like went off track and kind of cut the inside a little bit and got himself back in front of Kevin, which he probably shouldn't have. But no, I mean, it was just, like I said, it's not me being negative. It's just for what
I just
it was
think that's
what
funny.
Happened,
I hope he doesn't. I hope Chad's not an avid listener and now you're blocked on social.
Right.
I would hope not, damn it. But although there was huge fans of Windham that were happy to see Chad go up in smoke, but the guy deserved that win. But he asked a little bit too much of the Yamaha on that night. Daytona this weekend, I loved it during the day. And the fact that when we do things during the day more than ever with super motocross, can we make this a daytime race again, please?
You know, it's...
Why not? We do day races all the time now.
Well, I'll tell you exactly why not. Because when it was during the day, well, Daytona always used to be at the end of bike week.
Yeah.
And it was a day race. Well, since it was the end of bike week, everybody was leaving. Mm. Anybody that came down to ride their Harleys and everything during bike week, I mean, they still had to be back at work on Monday. So they'd be checking out of their rooms. Some of them would go to the Supercross, but the rest of them would get on I-95 and head home. And then they changed it to the night race, and it drew more fans in. Well, then because of the NFL expansion, and that's why we have the schedule that we have now with Daytona being as early into, well, now February for the first time ever. But with the NFL expansion moving to the extra week or extra 2 weeks, that pushed back the date on the Daytona 500. Well, pushed back the date on the Super Bowl first, which then pushed back the date on the Daytona 500.
Yeah.
And then it would have essentially pushed back the date another week on Daytona Supercross. The Supercross is pretty much the same date range within that 3-4 days as what it's always been.
Right.
But because of the way the calendar is now, and they moved it to the beginning of bike week and at night, that's why we have the massive crowds that we have. Because when it was a day race, it was at best half the crowd that we're getting now. So, I mean, it makes sense logistically and for ticket sales and all that stuff. Plus, everybody's there for the first day of bike week, the first official day of bike week on that Saturday of Daytona Supercross.
So then can we still just do it during the day and make it like it was before?
I think everybody would be pissed.
Oh, rats. Well, it does look good under the lights. But I romanticize Daytona Supercross because it was like it was a motocross Supercross. It was the most super motocross thing that has ever existed. It was a Supercross track carved out of the local soils, as well as some lime rock that used to just wreak havoc on everything. It was a 30 minute main, if I'm not mistaken.
And I don't know if it was 30 minute field. Main. 30-man field. I don't think it was a 30-minute race. Maybe back in the 70s when they first started it.
Yeah.
Maybe back in the 70s, because it was part of the motocross series initially. Before
Davey,
they made
Davey
it
Coombs would know. If he was sitting here right now, he would know.
Yeah, he would know. If anybody could get a hold of Gary Bailey, he would absolutely know.
I have to tag him in this clip.
Well, and then they used to run across Pitt Road back in the day.
Yeah.
Back in the 80s.
Those are some hell tracks as well.
And we're never going to get a rough track like we had back in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s. We're never going to get that.
No, it's not the same. It's not the same infrastructure. So
that infield grass where Daytona is, you know, inside that tri-oval there where the track actually is, all that grass is now compacted for the car races. So if anybody gets off in the infield, they're not going to catch and roll 17 times. That's right. And they're not allowed to dig down in there anymore.
Like right, exactly. Doing. So it's a completely different world. But
we'll
I did
the telephone poles in.
Yeah. No, we're done with the telephone poles. but yeah, I do love Daytona Supercross. Before we leave the 450 class, I need a yes or no. Will there be another 450 class main event winner in 2026?
I'm going to say no. I think we've...
Okay, why?
I think we've reached our limit, pretty much. There had to be something really weird to happen to get a sixth winner. The only reason I would say yes is if we had gotten to seven rounds without Chase winning a race. If he hadn't won A2 and we only had four winners after seven rounds, then I would absolutely say yes, because Chase is on that list to get a win. But since he already has it, and you look at the guys that are in that 7-8 range, I don't really see that happening. The only guy that I could think that would maybe get in there would be Justin Cooper, but he's got to get a start. He's got the speed, but his starts are just not there. But he's the only one that I see right now in an aggregate, in a volume, that could actually do it. You made a great case for Joey earlier. That would be awesome. I'd love to just see him get on a podium, get on two or three podiums this year. And this season,
that'd
the
be
win for Joey.
Absolutely. Extremely successful year. Absolutely.
But I think when you look at it in a vacuum, I think Jay Coop would be the last one in this field that could do it.
All right. But, well, I have Jason Anderson on line one. you're absolutely right. If we do get another, it would only probably just be one more. And if you were to narrow that down, hard not to say a guy like Jay Coop. Anderson RV has a single race win at a triple crown. Does that mean that he could win a main event? Perhaps. But also at the same time, it could be a great night for Malcolm Stewart, who got a win last year. The depth of the class and when these guys are on, hot or cold, is just incredible so far this season. And it's made for great racing. It's made for great storylines. How about we say we move over to, I got an interview now with an actual.
Before we do that, I just remembered this. Mm. There's one outlier, Daytona specific, that we have not mentioned at all in this show, and because he has not raced the last 2 weeks. That could be a factor, especially if it rains.
Oh.
Because he's going to be back this week, and that's Jorge.
George is back.
Yep. He's going to be back, and if anybody can win Daytona, especially if it's going to be muddy, it's going to be him.
Okay. So, actually, this is a good time to maybe talk about it, is that, Kyle, we haven't done a podcast together since before the season. And I guess we can safely say that we were wrong about Jorge Prado.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what we...
Whatever we said, we were probably wrong.
Probably. I do think I remember, like, I don't remember my exact verbiage, of course, but I do think I said something about, you know, if he could get back to what he was pre-Cowie days, because, you know, a lot of conversations have happened over the years with various riders about the inner workings within that organization and how they manage things. And then the whole Jake Weimer saga from last week on Pulp was probably the biggest blow up to the whole theory and proving a lot of people right.
Right.
And just Prado's riding this year before he had that crash last week. That plus what Jake said is the two biggest, you know, here you go. You know, here's exactly what I've been proving. Now, granted, Prado quit on Kawasaki.
Yeah, like that was
starting to see more of maybe why he did based on what Jake said. I think I think the pieces are starting to align there to where it makes more sense as to why Jorge did things the way he did, probably based on the way Cowie did what they did. Maybe we're wrong.
Right. Or, yeah, well, that's a situation that can kind of snowball, is that like you feel like the team's quitting on you by not giving you more options, that you start to quit on the team because you feel like they're quitting on you. They start to quit on you more because you're being more difficult to work with, and the situation gets worse and worse on both sides. Especially like relationships for whatever reason in this industry seem to be nuclear. When they go sideways, they go fucking super sideways, and there's a lot of hurt feelings and, not even always the most professionalism, at times. And, that can be a real problem when it comes to like contracts and rider communication and how he works with different teams, man. Like it's how things end up working out between different teams can be so different depending on the situation they're in. But right now Kawasaki has to be scratching their head that like it's not a great look when your best guy, who does have a win this year, is routinely more off the pace and more off of what we've come to expect from him. And, it hasn't been great for Marchbanks. I'll just say that. Like,
no. And I mean, he's missed two races already out of seven. Now I will say his qualifying last weekend, at least in the first session, was really good.
He's shown glimpses. Like seventh.
Yeah. I think he was seventh in that qualifying session. Granted, you know, all the way back to Eli in 12th, they were still within a second. It was still like 8/10 between first to 12th. So, and that's just putting your wheel wrong in a rut, honestly. But, you know, as far as
Chase, I think you look better on a club Yamaha. I'll say it.
I think so. I
think you look better on a club Yamaha.
Well, and you know, as far as Chase goes, yeah, he's got the win, but when in seven races, when you've got one win and only one other podium in seven races, that's not a great look.
Yeah.
When you're the guy. And then, you know, like I started saying before, like with everything that Weimer ranted on about last week on Steve's show, you know, this might get a little bit long winded, cut me off at any point, but when I talk to riders in the off-road game that have switched bikes from year to year and they struggle, you know, I didn't have a factory ride. I never had a factory ride. I never even had anything close to a factory ride or support or anything like that. But I've been around this sport long enough and ridden enough bikes. I know what to look for and what to feel for. And I've talked to off-road riders in the past that have switched machines from one year to the next. They go into the season and they struggle. And, you know, when I talk to certain people, and I kind of get an idea of what's going on, I'll go and ask the rider. I'm like, straight up, did you ever ride your bike, your current bike right now, bone stock before the team ever touched it with suspension or anything, suspension being the biggest component? Mm-hmm. And they're like, no. 9 times out of 10, it's been a no. They never did. I'm like, why not? Because when you think about it, any one of those bikes, good or bad, they're designed out of the box stock to be ridden a certain way.
Yeah. And they have a certain balance to them. They're designed specifically.
Right. And you ride one for a half hour the way it is. Yeah. I mean, change the springs inside, but don't change the valving or anything, but change the springs inside for your weight at least, but go out and ride the thing. You feel how that thing reacts. And then you go from there. All these, so many of these factory guys and these teams, they're trying to make a works bike, you know, production, whatever, but a factory bike, what they're riding now is supposed to be comparable to the last thing that they felt or the previous, you know, two bikes that they felt when it was good. And they're trying to compare to that. And that's the wrong mentality, in my opinion. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But you need to take right. the bike how it is stock, and that's your base. You need to compare, you need to adjust your suspension, your setup, and the chassis and everything else based on the stock product that you're on, and not compare a Suzuki to a Honda or a Yamaha to a Kawasaki. That's just, that doesn't always work. Have guys won doing that? Absolutely. But should you? I don't think so. And especially when you look at guys that can't get it consistently done.
Right. So it's gone bad more times than it's gone well.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're still throwing darts at the wall with Chase. I don't know how many darts they're throwing with Garrett, but at least it's Chase. I mean, they've said it on the broadcast. Cowie is very open about the fact that they're throwing darts at the wall and hoping something sticks. But should they just go back to the basics, take a bone stock 450, let him ride it? Obviously, you can't do that with it on Supercross, but you can get, at least get it close with stock suspension. But get the feel of the bike, then start throwing shit on it with a suspension and go from there.
But how are we here in the eighth week of 2026? A guy who has been on Cowies since, what, November 1?
Probably even October.
Okay. So 10 weeks of solid Supercross testing and we can't get comfortable?
Yeah.
Like that's wild to me. Like, cause you gotta be able to find the ballpark, and then you as a rider have to adapt yourself to how do I get the most out of this package right here?
Well, and that's going back to what I'm saying though, like, the package that he started on, is that ultimately not a great package? Kawasaki tells him it's a great package right. because guys have won on that package, even though this current model for the last 3 years, nobody's won on that package except for 5 weeks ago or, you know, 4 weeks ago.
Right.
Is, you know, did somebody finally win it's on not proven. That particular edition bike? But other than that, there's nothing there. And, you know, I never really gave this a thought when we did the pre-race show or anything else, but was there a lingering injury with Chase from that SMX crash in Vegas where he lawn darted himself and the bike tackled him? We never got word on whether he was good or bad from that. We've seen him ride, you know, for so long before the turn of the year.
Yeah.
But was he really 100%?
That could be another aspect of it. Yeah, who's to say? He's always had a quiet camp. When going through an off season, you don't hear a ton. I know Chase likes to be a kid from Illinois and just go back home and enjoy himself. I think I love that part of who he is as a professional athlete. But in the world of professional motocross, there isn't a lot of insider information and stuff like that, or that certainly that's not the kind of stuff that they put out in PR releases. So. It's just, we're sort of at the mercy of the information available to us unless, I don't know how truthful he'd be with people that are outside of the periphery. You know what I mean? Less information out there is better information out there when it comes to, being a professional athlete in a single individual sport like this.
Which I think hurts our sport. And ultimately, what do you gain from it as a rider not being open about it? I mean, if it's something really, really bad that really doesn't have any effect on you riding the motorcycle, you know, physically, but if it's something mental or whatever that, you know, you don't want people to know about, okay, fine. But if we're 2 months down the road and you're fine, but you still don't tell anybody what was going on and be truthful about it, so people can be like, that actually makes sense. Like
every year we have one of those. Every year there's somebody who flounders and rides like shit at the beginning of the year, and perhaps that's Chase Sexton this year, although I wouldn't say he's been riding like shit. He has a race win. And yeah, anyway, that like you find out years later, the guy, oh yeah, I had a dislocated shoulder. I rode my race bike, a week before, A1. And you're like, oh, that would have been good to know at the time when I was making my championship predictions.
Right. And unless there's an agreement with the rider and the team, if there's an injury or something to not race,
yeah,
then if you're going to race being injured, then there needs to be disclosure on it. There needs to be, or not disclosure, but transparency on it.
Well, so and now that we have betting, there needs to be more of that. If there's going to be gambling,
there absolutely needs to be more of that. Correct.
Because like that's gambling is literally why the injury report exists.
Correct.
It's that it has nothing to do with how the other team is preparing for who's going to be squaring off. That is so that Jim Bob knows to play money line against, for the Chargers to beat the San Francisco 49ers. I don't know, but it all comes down to betting and gambling and stuff like that. And we need more transparency. And I don't know if we're even going to get it.
We're not going to get it under the current model because there's a separate betting line that has nothing to do with 17 of the 22 guys that are on the racetrack.
Right.
And when them starting a heat race that night means that they're getting paid that night, that makes the difference. They don't have to make the main. They're getting money from a purse, and that matters to the back 10 guys.
Mm-hmm.
That matters. Whereas in any other actual professional sports league, the NHL, the NBA, the MLB, those guys are getting paid no matter what they do. The only reason for them to play is for a performance clause for X amount of points, number of sacks, number of goals scored. Their money does not change. Whereas in Supercross and Motocross, you have to run most of those contracts. You have to run X amount of races to get either half, three quarters, the full deal.
Yeah.
If you don't, you get jack shit. So yeah, if you've got a contract that says that and you know, hey, I might not make six races this year, then I at least need to start the heat race because that $1,500 from the night show is going to mean a difference for me paying the electricity bill this month.
Yeah. It's our sports
until
wild.
Until we get to a point, if we ever get to a point where guys are paid no matter what their finish position is on the night, if they're paid before they even show up to the stadium. Now I'm not talking about the factory guys. I'm talking about the other 65 guys that show up 250 and 450 class. If we ever get to a point where they're getting decent money to be there and their finish position does not affect what their bank account says at all, then we're going to get more transparency. But until that day comes, we're not going to get it.
Then if we have that, we don't have racing. We would just have, it would be like the WWE of.
Well, then we do though, because then it gets back to why we started racing motorcycles in the first place. One, because it's fun, but two, money aside, you want to be that number one guy.
Of course,
we all lined up as amateurs because we wanted to beat that guy next to us. We wanted to beat the guy on the other side of us. Yeah. We weren't getting
there was a race happening, and I said I was the fastest.
Exactly. We weren't getting $15,000. Then it becomes pure and becomes, I want to win because I want to beat your ass and say I'm the best guy. Not because I'm going to get $10 million at the end of the year.
Fair enough. We got to throw it to the 250 class. Before we do that, I had Tyler Ruchteschel. Tyler Ruchteschel. I'm allowed to not remember that last name. Well, not remember it, but like have that one stump you. That is a highly stumpable last name. I might leave this in the pod. I really like chatting with this guy. He was working on the floor this weekend with Feld. He was a volunteer position. He's done it for a number of years, and he actually used to race the KJSC way back in the day, which is unreal. That whole story, please enjoy it. That's Tyler Ruckdeschel here on the Big MX Radio podcast, brought to you by Luxon MX1. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio podcast. I'm your host, Brad Gebhardt. With me on the line, a very, very, very special guest. Him and I go back and forth on Instagram. Feels like every other day, at least, if not for sure every week. A massive fan of the sport. He's been around it for a long period of time, and he was on the floor. He's the man on the scene this last weekend in Dallas. It's not the Arlington Supercross. It's the Dallas Supercross of the Monster Energy Supercross series. Tyler Ruckdeschel. Tyler, welcome to the podcast.
Appreciate it, man. Glad to be on.
Stoked to have you on the show, my friend. You are a longtime listener and a longtime follower and contributor over at Big MX Radio on Instagram. For those who aren't already following, and for those who aren't following you yet, where do they go find out?
I'm pretty much just on Instagram right now. I do some stuff on YouTube, but nothing mainstream. It's pretty much Instagram's the way to go. 29 truck.
Fair enough. What? Yeah, the 129 truck needs to be an instant follow for anybody taking in this particular podcast. But Tyler, the reason why we're having you on the show right now is because you were boots on the ground. You were not the eye in the sky. You were. I got to find out what spot on the track that you were at. But like before we get to that, give us a little bit of a 411 on all things Tyler Ruckdeschel. Paint the picture for us, and then we'll get into this weekend.
Yeah, so I bleed the moto stuff in the community, racing obviously pretty much my whole life since I was three. My family and I used to promote some series in different states, Missouri, Texas. We primarily do stuff on the woods front. A lot of national enduros and stuff like that, but man, born and bred in Texas moto and pretty much the peak in the 90s. So I'm ingrained with a lot of the scene here, and we've been doing, a lot of the supercross stuff volunteer wise since like 2011, 2012. So it's, we live it.
No doubt. We live and breathe it. So then I gotta ask, like, who is in your opinion, the greatest talent to ever come out of Texas? There's been a lot, not a lot of championships. Of course, a lot of people can't think of a guy like Ken Howard, but, what's the first name that jumps off the page when it comes to Texas motocross for you?
You know, I'd say lately, and it's probably a little bit biased, but I'd say Masterful's got a lot of good stuff going. He may have stuff in the background, but we go train at their place every once in a while. And honestly, from their perspective as a fan, seeing the work go in and then seeing how many people flock to their area, you know, they've got, I speak with Jake on a fairly regular basis, and you know, just what they're growing up in there. I mean, like you said, there's moto everywhere here in North Texas, and it just seems like that, at least right now, is the place to be.
Fair enough. Tough to argue. Yeah, I don't know if there's too many Texas-born racers that have a win in the 2020s, Master Pruel is certainly one of them. Intermittent, the level of support first name's escaping me. Ty Master Pruel receives, and I don't think it's a secret that at times the Master Pruels can be, I guess, tricky to work with is the right term. But I honestly see that more as a group of people who demand and command to be like supported at a certain level. And if they're not going to receive that level of support or that level of buy-in, then we're not in. Which is fair, because I know there's also a lot of situations in the sport where athletes receive less than optimal support and less than they're willing to accept less, and for that reason they're considered to be agreeable and not such sandpaper. To which I'd say, well, like if you just treat everybody good, then everybody's good, easy to deal with. Would not be surprised to see him on a Star Racing Yamaha outdoors this year. Right now he's on the Gizmo Mods, Yamaha. He was doing it kind of all by himself, for the Houston Supercross, didn't make the main, but yeah, a little bit more wind in the sails for Ty Master Pruel. Like you said, you've been in the sport for a long period of time. You grew up racing in North Texas, correct?
Yes, correct. I grew up in it pretty much 96 to 2000. We moved back to Missouri where our family's originally from. Mm-hmm. We do have connections there a little bit. We actually, my dad's mentor was Gary Emig. He passed last year. Jeff Emig's dad.
Of course.
So being in that scene, and then in the mid-2000s, a few years later, moved back to Texas, pretty much the opposite side of the Metroplex, but the same general area, and kind of picked up where we left off. So
fair enough. So we wanted to have you on the podcast because you were on the floor this last weekend with Supercross. What was your role? How did you come to either volunteer for it or work for it? How does that all come together? Who do you contact? And I guess give me some takeaways from your weekend.
Yeah, so it's funny because we had potentially the opportunity to do this years before we did. We just didn't really have the right in at the time. But one of the old enduro crews used to do the Texas Stadium for forever. The Red River Dirt Riders, they used to put on, they did some Red Bull events back in the late 2000s, the Red Bull Last Man Standing. Okay. And, we got into their group doing a lot of work, putting on races, going. And, it was a few years after that, they're like, hey, we're moving new stadiums. They're kind of refreshing the crew. We need some volunteers. You guys want to come help? So we joined the flag crew. And,
yes.
Well, because we had done Freestone on the kind of the same gig for the years they had that before it hopped off the national schedule. So we're like, yeah, indoors.
Yeah, until everyone kept getting heat exhaustion and dying.
Yeah. Oh, God, it was brutal. Yeah, Tomac's first year was insane. He comes out of Hangtown.
Just ask ripping. Brett Metcalf.
Oh, yeah.
Well, was that also not like, no, just bring a morbid side of things. Was that not the Josh Lichtel situation?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it's I'm
pretty sure that was that was Freestone, which is tragic.
Yes,
but that is, I guess, got to be the reason why we don't go back there.
Yeah, 100%. Because they would choose to do it at the earliest point they could, and it was just still too much. I mean, it's crazy to think now with kind of how the summer goes. Yeah, it's always hot in moto, but when it's, you know, triple digits and they're pushing those limits, it's insane. So yeah, it's and that was back when it was, you know, full 2-day events and that kind of stuff. So they've condensed it a little, made it better for the riders. And as we've seen the past few years, you know, they'll shorten it if they need to, just to make it safer. And safety's huge. I mean, that's another reason we got involved with these clubs. But we had originally got through, and so we were on the flag crew. Our first year, we actually swept the floor, which seems like it's brutal, but you get to do a lot of watching, which is pretty cool because you don't ever do anything with people around the track. But a couple of years after that, I actually got finagled into helping with the block pulling for the mechanics. And to me, that's the greatest gig because, one, you get a little bit of a workout because you get to pull some blocks back and forth. It's like doing sled pulls.
Okay.
But the fun part is during the racing, you can actually look around. Like if you're flagging, you get one spot. You get your zone. Right. You look down track. That's all you see all day. There, you can walk around, kind of look behind the scenes. You get to interact with the mechanics a little bit. And I've got a lot of buddies that I usually, you know, high five, you know, stuff like that. See some of the photographers and stuff. But it's the thing about it is this weekend, especially, I was literally 5 feet away from the finish line. So I could see everything unfold.
So you might have a little bit of insight on just one of the biggest a little bit of controversy. In fact, if we replay the tape, maybe you're in frame.
I think one of those I'm standing at the point of the Triumph block right there. And so I didn't see the beginning of the 451 right before it happened, but I did see all of the 251 as it was going down, and we're hands in the air going, "Oh no, man." So yeah, it's nuts.
Now I'm going to get into that with Kyle Wolf, but I do would like your 2 cents on it is how the fuck do we have that happen in 2 straight races?
It's
the same problem, but different. One, the lights are on, no flag. The other time, flag is out, no lights. Okay. Can't get our story straight. Can't get our situation straight. Either way. The other side has argument as to why, like, a result happened the way it did. Obviously, Joe Shimoda not stoked, because he ended up losing a victory over it, essentially. Although I would argue that, Pierce Brown wasn't rolling, and that might not have made a difference. But hey, that, like, if that doesn't make a difference, then why do we have a rule book, right? So what were your thoughts?
So, and this comes from a couple angles. So, like I said, we used to promote racing series, so I'm well-versed in the logistics behind decisions that are made, you know, especially the things you really have to, go to the pages and say, okay, where can we allow ourselves the freedom to make decisions that maybe aren't agreeable? As a fan watching it, obviously we've seen for years, the whole point of adding the lead-in lights was because, hey, we can't see the flags. And then as a racer, how do you go? A TV does not do it justice. Those guys come out of that turn. They're doing the double. They're committed to the finish before they hit the face of the double. And one of the points of contention there that was, it was frustrating to kind of witness. And I know I kind of have to tiptoe a little bit on what I can say as a rep, but the in between the motos, after they had the issue, they moved the light back. So what they did is they took the light from the face of the double before the finish to the landing of the double before the finish in between the main. So they already knew they had some drama, and then that kind of made a little more of an issue because now you're committed, you're on the face, and then you see the light if it was on for the 450s. And that's even more.
Because so the light is for the finish line, not that jump. Because obviously when you're in your air, you're like, okay, cool, thanks for the info.
And what we do, and you know, having been around the block on flagging, normally as a flagger, you're set before the face, because if you're on the face or after the face, riders aren't going to see it. And especially the finish line. I mean, that guy, there are two groups, and I guess I want to highlight that. The volunteer flaggers are always the just yellow flag crews.
Yes.
And then the AMA flaggers, the ones with the blue flags.
Yes.
The AMA flaggers are the ones who operate the red lead-in lights. The other lights are handled by the volunteer flag crew. That I need to stipulate, because that's where it comes into play, how things are done, because people see a yellow flag or a red flag and they think it's all the same, you know, group. We at least don't have a hand in judgment calls there, which is good. But with that said, it's we heard, hey, the light got left on and they're having a technical issue with it. So for me, coming from it from that perspective, the biggest thing is consistency, man. It's tough. And like you said, with Joe's case, he's handled it well. All of his comments on social media have been, you know, oh, I'm just worried about rider safety. And that's probably the biggest thing. Like, now you've created a situation where riders are going to say, well, maybe I should jump. Maybe I'll just deal with it and get docked later if they're going to do it. And then you create that situation of, if there is somebody there, that's the crux of it. So that's, it's tough, man. It's, and seeing it live too, when you're like, dude, he's on a roll, they're right next to each other, and you see one of the riders roll, you're like, what's going on? So yeah, it's tough, man.
Yeah, it is. And then on top of that, like we've sort of, things have sort of changed over time with the yellow flag. It used to be a no jumping, no passing. Then it was okay, you can jump, but no passing. Because like, as far as like jumping the full, like as far as I've ever been can explain the yellow flag, that's not a wheels on the ground jump, but that is a proceed with caution.
Yes.
Which is why at the pro level, they have no problem jumping stuff on a yellow. As soon as it's red, like that's wheels on the ground. But sometimes wheels on the ground, if I get a foot of air, is that five positions or?
Yes.
You know what I mean? There's
and that gray area, so like for subjective. The outdoors, we did wheels on the ground one year where we had the yellow flag and the wheels on the ground flag. And that was, it was basically just a red cross, but it was that same idea, right? You're like, okay, can you get some momentum as long as you're not doing a jump? If it's a rhythm section, you can do the single. Like, how fast can you enter this? It's almost like when they do those offset starts. Like, how much is enough of an edge to where you're not quite over the line rule-wise versus, okay, we're going to still make this a race.
Right.
So for those situations, it is tough. Like, I've seen people online saying, oh, man, we should just do a full course red flag or cross flag. Make everybody have the same penalty. It's like, yeah, that's really not manageable, especially with lap traffic and stuff. And you already see it with the blue flags, right? They've got this new point system and you see a little bit better, but at the same time, it's like, it's really hard because they're doing the race and you're talking less than a minute lap time. I mean, the top guys are lapping up into the top 10, you know? So from a promoting any, I could see where it's frustrating having to even deal with that, but they did kind of box themselves into a degree by saying, hey, it's either or. And then now the hard line stance is, well, if it's not both, so now you're gonna have riders looking, hey, I see a cross flag, but I didn't see the lights. And I think that's what somebody said about Brown. They're like, oh, I didn't see the lights. That was his line. And then you see the picture of him whipping right next to it. It's like, yeah, he might not have seen it. He's probably looking further down because, you know, he's racing.
Yeah, you're supposed to be looking up. No, like I've always been told, look up the track. I wasn't looking at the side where the lights are, bro. Yeah, all I want is them to be consistent on it.
Yes.
And that so that for no other reason than rider safety, that these guys can know when to take what seriously or when to take a yeah, when to be wheels on the ground or when to proceed with caution. If it's not done consistently, guys will just, all right, well, this is a competitive sport. I'm racing. I'm just going to go for it. And when we can work out the rest later. And that's how you end up with somebody on the downside of a landing. Either you jump into somebody's motorcycle or you land on somebody. And you as well as I know, that could be an absolute catastrophe. So aside from that drama, had to have been a solid weekend altogether. What's time frame like for you? Like how early do they want you at the track? And then once the checkered flag flies, is it a volunteer thing? You get your t-shirt and a hot dog and you head out, or what's the deal?
it's evolved.
Please tell me there's hot dogs.
Well, it's Jerry's World. If we get anything there, it's upstairs. And man, the first couple of years, they wouldn't even, we went in and you'd have to take your lid off your water bottle. But when you went into security the first two or three years,
yeah.
And they're like, you can't even take this in there. Now it's like they got security. You can take your bags. Cause as a volunteer effort, it's always been whatever. Like it's, hey, you get a shirt. They turned that into, hey, you get a couple tickets. So you get some people who get to go sit in rider seating. So it's like, hey, if you know some buddies or some family,
we need to make this thing look full.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's a win-win for the stadium. And the first few years, a lot of the riders would sit in it. So it was like, it wasn't just blanket industry seating. Like my first year sweeping the floor, because we didn't have to sweep after the last race, we could go up in the stands. And that night, Wharton did pretty good. And I see him walking by, and I'm buddies with
another Texas tornado. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I said, hey, good ride. And he's like, hey, yeah. Hands me his water bottle. Freaking Geico water bottle. So I took it to the pits afterwards. I said, hey, I appreciate it. He signed it for me. And that's one of those things. It's like, you don't even think about that. Whereas now it's a more consistent effort. So we're not scrounging to get people. So you've got people who, for the most part, it's a consistent crew. And lately, the past couple of years, because of the guys running it, you've got people for multiple rounds. So we're starting to get that consistency of experienced people who really go above and beyond at their own events, travel to other events. We actually, my family and I, are on the list for one of the SMX rounds later in the year, up in Missouri. So it's nice. Like, I may or may not do that, but it's one of those, it's been more worth it. And now they do a little more corporate stuff. So like we sign paperwork, we had to do some, now that sports betting's a thing, we have to do some.
Oh yeah, it is. That.
So we got to dot our I's and cross our T's. So that's where they're like, hey, you can't give any high fives. Although they did say, if a rider initiates a high five, you're allowed to give him one now, because that deal last year, or whatever, with Jet when
he got a bunch of them
off the track. He had to give himself.
You got Tomac going up for a high five, and you're like, "Sorry, bro."
Yep.
Oh,
so they kind of get strict about that. And then the film crews like to stand wherever they want to go. So like for us, the barriers, any given time, we could be right next to the start. We could be halfway down the start straight. And so they'll set up and start propping up, get ready for interviews before the gate goes. And you're like, hey guys, we got to run through here right behind you. And then right after the race, like this past time, I'm sitting there in my spot and then Hunter stops right there. They're cheering for him and they got him on camera. And I'm like, okay, don't make eye contact. Don't act like you're in the shot. Just be natural kind of thing. When all you want to do is be like, oh yeah, man, that was awesome.
Yeah. Like, no, you gotta the only it. Thing people can't do when they say act natural is act natural.
Exactly. And that's, so it's, so yeah, they've made that part of it a little bit better. And then this year, you know, they do things like we used to have to go to the pits for food and it made it a little bit tough. Cause it's like, we only get like an hour and a half break. This year it was a little more streamlined. They had some stuff for us. So we were able to kind of enjoy our downtime because we get there, you know, like 7:30, we show up, get signed in, walk. It used to be blocks away. Now we're near the stadium, but it used to be, oh, go wait at the roll call, wait till they open. And then you got to make it from there to downstairs at the back of the stadium in like 30 minutes. So yeah, it's been chaotic in the past. Now I would say it's gotten to be where it's more just fun. Like we were more involved at different levels over the years. And it's like some years you get done, you're like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm like, it's too much work for what it is. I'd rather just be a fan. And then, you know, every year we turn around and say, no, we want to do it. This year is the first time where even the next day I'm like, oh, I'm pumped. I'm ready for more.
There you go. So, right yeah. back at it. Yeah, no, it's that's motocross though. That's why the foot pegs are sharp. They dig their teeth in. They don't let go. So for yourself, like, are you, and you've been on the floor before, we'll get into that in a second here, but, are you like sort of just ever, like it never really gets old of just seeing the fastest racers in the world do exactly what they're like. These guys live and breathe it. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
It's every day for these guys.
Yeah, it's you see. First of all, you see some of these guys when you're looking at them on TV and you're like, man, they look like monsters on the bikes. And then the first couple of years, you're like, dude, these guys are like jockeys, man. They're lean and trim and ready to go. And you get to see it's especially during the morning, during qualifying and practice and stuff, you can see what changes they're making. You know, you look at the bikes come in, you know, you're just your rebound, you're playing with clickers. Some guys go in and you can see that magic mechanic thing of, oh, I'm going to make a change, and they're not even changing anything. But then, you know, you look at the bike,
just wipe it off.
Yeah. Right. You get to see like the machinery so up close, like you get an appreciation for it, man, this is a couple hundred pound motorcycle flying through the air. You're making it look super graceful. You know, you watch Tomac go flying by, pitch sideways in the middle of a straightaway. You're like, dude, if I was on the brakes here, like I still wouldn't make that turn, and you're still on the gas. So yes.
That always blows me away is the guys who are still wide open pinned in a section where I would have let off the gas and been coasting into the corner an hour ago.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's the adrenaline rush. Like I every year my watch is like pinging me saying, hey, your heart rate's getting high. Is everything okay? And it's right before you got pyro going, you got guys on the start. I was actually near the pyro stand and the guy came over. He's like, hey, you got to back up like 15 feet because we're going to be shooting flames off this thing. And you're just sitting there and it's like, man, I feel like I'm on the gate ready to go and I'm not even lined up.
Remember when they used to give Monster Girls flamethrowers?
Oh yeah.
That was never a good idea. I always wait for one of them to like the hairspray catches on fire and we just have a massacre happening on the like, that'd be terrible. Unreal. So you'd do it again?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. It's every time we get that call, we're like, yeah, we're in. So I'm to the point where I would say I would encourage other people to seek out like the contact stuff for them. It's kind of, like I said, it's kind of a closed list right now, but we're always looking for more people that are interested. And then we get kind of a wait list that backs up at different rounds, you know, because they always need help.
Fair enough. So if somebody is interested in partaking in something like this, they could reach out to someone like yourself and you'd be able to steer them in the right direction.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is there's recently we do have age requirements. It used to be you could have like, you know, high school kids out there, but it's you got to be 18 just for liability and stuff. But yeah, that's pretty much the only thing. If you're focused and ready, they're always willing to take new people. And if you do a good job, they'll invite you back.
So you go to Instagram, 29truck, and of course that is T-Ruck is your the first syllable of your last name. Tyler Ruckdeschel here on the Big MX Radio podcast. Yeah, man, you got to send me some videos. You must have taken some videos while you're down there, although I'm sure.
I get a little bit. They think better about it. It used to be at the beginning, they're like, no cell phones, you can't do anything. But every year I try to get a little bit of something.
Yeah, I honestly like the whole like the stick in the mud that they are. I get that like, they want you to work. They don't want you to just be on your phone the entire time. But like when you say like rather than saying hey, like try and keep the phone use to a minimum and actually like treat people like adults.
Yep.
And say like hey, we know it's a pretty cool experience to be on the floor. If you could take a handful of videos throughout the night, like, and you feel like you have, it's not going to affect your work whatsoever, by all means.
Oh yeah. Exactly.
Take a video, enjoy yourself. We appreciate your time down there. If it becomes a problem, you will be removed and you won't be welcome back. But to say that you're not allowed to take any videos at all, just like, honestly, just this makes people come off as shitty in general. And, like, I absolutely cannot stand shit like that. But, yeah, that's neither here nor there. for a guy like yourself, like you'd mentioned, this is not the first time you've done this. But you've been on the floor at for a supercross with a bike underneath you as well. I think we need to shed light on that story before I call up I actually probably just add him to the podcast at this point. Kyle Wolf is going to be joining me shortly, but yeah, give me a little bit of a peek behind the curtain of how you were able to line up for a supercross, although it might have been an itty bitty one at the time.
Oh yeah, no, it's, and it was in the early years. So back in 1998, it might have been the first or second year they did it.
No kidding. Were you racing against Tony Alessi?
I raced against both the Alessi kids, and then, Kennard and some of those guys, in the local scene here. And my dad, you know, we went to the shop as you do, and they started spreading word. Hey, they're doing this KTM Junior Supercross thing. And my dad's like, that sounds interesting. What's the age bracket? And he looked up the stuff and he's like, all right, how do I get on this list? And, sure enough, we managed to get it not only on the list, but at our hometown race, which was freaking so cool. And at the time, McGrath was on his Yamaha, cause we got to go see Button and McGrath. We got our signatures, or they got signatures on our jerseys and stuff. We got a set of gloves, a jersey and pants. And, now they do way more. I mean, they get GoPros and all this other stuff, but we got to go ride a KTM at the time, the KTM Senior 50s. And they just gave you a number. I'm number four. So I was talking to all the number fours every year. Like, hey, this is what I used to do at one point in time. And yeah, they had us back then in the old Texas stadium. I know the track stuff's gotten a lot better, but the freaking whoops were huge. And so they had us go through at the beginning. And I mean, they're full on peaked out. We're basically bottoming out these things, just going over them. And they're like, no, these are going to be too gnarly for the kids. So the second practice, everybody went around it. I mean, we were barely getting over the finish line and stuff, you know. That's now the awesome. Kids are like doubling, you know, here and there.
Oh, yeah. No, you had, is it, speaking of Texas products, I think you had, is it Braxton or Bryson Smith was jumping the finish line at Arena Cross this weekend?
Yep.
That's insane.
It's nuts. And the scene here is like, you get these kids that go to these camps and stuff and they're just flying. And now I think there's a bit more of a pecking order to that stuff. Cause it's very high demand for, especially with the electric bikes. But it's such a good crew, and a lot of the same people who have been involved through generations are involved in the program still. So it's pretty cool. So
that's super cool. And do you remember how you finished?
I remember I got a good start, and then they had added the whoops back in for our race, and I tried jumping into them. I know I didn't get last after that point, but I did go for a cartwheel. But I do know that, like, at the time I wasn't, I liked to ride, but I didn't have the bug. But a couple years after that, man, when you get that, oh, I can actually win races mentality, it changes everything. So that, I think, put me on that path a little bit quicker for sure.
You're bit by the bug. And like I said, yeah, it sinks its teeth and won't let go. Tyler Ruckdeschel here on the Big MX Radio podcast. Dude, it was so much fun to have you on. I really appreciate your insight and your feedback. I hope you had some fun with this. And
sure.
Sounds like it won't be the last time we have on the show. So I really appreciate you taking some time to give us a little bit of a peek behind the curtain of how the sausage gets made over at Supercross. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, man. Thank you. Look forward to it.
And we're back. Thanks for everybody taking the time to listen and watch that interview with Tyler Ruckdeschel. Really, really fun guy to chat with. Honestly, I don't know if you know this, but Kyle, but the volunteer crew is often like a volunteer crew from sort of that area. They've worked a lot of like events and stuff in the past, and Tyler's one of them. And he was like literally standing right next to those lights or that little double right before the finish line, which I'm sure will be the crux of our entire 250 class conversation. But yeah, really cool to chat with him.
Yeah, absolutely. And as much as people complain about the volunteer aspect of this, I think we can get away with having volunteer flaggers. There's enough people around the country that know what's going on, that know enough about racing to be competent flaggers. I do wonder at times that there's a disconnect with the people that are flagging and the people technically above them on the race weekend. They're giving them directives about how to flag the races and so forth. I wonder if there's a disconnect there, but I think there is enough people around to where we have competent flaggers and competent people running the lights. Because how do we end up with a malfunction other than just a straight up electrical glitch? I don't understand it.
Yeah. And there's no explanation given, which I find, upsetting. Like there's, it's the same conversation we had before we threw it to commercial, in my interview with Tyler Ruchtishell, is they're so reluctant to give out any amount of real, this is what went wrong. And there was two different situations. We didn't even talk about it during the 450 class, but like in the 450 class, you had a flag with no lights. 250 class, you got lights and no flag.
Well, so 450, Hunter actually said there were lights. He did see lights. Hunter said he saw lights on the downside of the double.
They moved the light. So that's the thing is, yeah. And then Tyler gets it that as well, is that in the 250 main, it's on the takeoff. Correct. In the 450 main, it's on the landing. So if I see those, if I'm in the air off that double, am I rolling the finish line?
Yeah. If I see the lights, when I know the previous rule was if you see lights, you don't jump, but now they're lead in lights. So they're telling you, hey, there's a flag coming up. We can't be doing that on a rough, rutted track. You can't expect guys to not be focused on what's right in front of them.
These guys are not looking at that.
Who's it for? Absolutely not looking at that, which is why for 70 years, ever since the invention of motocross, when it used to be scrambles back in the day, a guy frantically waving a flag around wasn't bulletproof, but 98% of the time it was fine.
Yeah, people see it.
And the flaggers, whether it's an amateur race or back in the day when, you know, supercross and motocross was way more lax than what it is now, those flaggers put themselves in position, you know, technically, you know, in harm's way, but they absolutely looked out for the riders back then and put themselves in harm's way to make sure that the guy on the other side of them that was down with his motorcycle wasn't going to get landed on and make it worse. The flaggers back in the day, and I mean, you still see in amateur racing now, those flaggers absolutely put themselves on the line to make sure that the guy that's already down isn't going to end up worse. And we need to get back to that. We need to figure out a system to get back to that point to where the flagger, the guy with a flag, not a light, is every single one of these riders resort to make sure that a bad situation doesn't become worse.
Yeah, that takes people stepping up is what it takes. But I'm just a little bit confused on how the malfunction would even sort of happen and then not really enforce the rule. I'm like, well, it went on. It went on, so you have to enforce the rule with it being on. Yes, no? Like,
well, I mean, they're so inconsistent. It's the wording on what rule they're going.
But the light was on, but it wasn't supposed to be. Okay, well, it wasn't
a light that says, "Hey, you don't have to, you can't jump." It was a light saying, "Hey, you're coming up to a section that you're not supposed to jump." Like, everything is contradicting itself so bad. How is anybody supposed to follow that?
Yeah. We have the not jumping is coming up, just letting you know, courtesy these lights. I don't think that that's crossing the mind of Pierce Brown on his way to his first win of the season, which did not get taken away from him. So I guess that is the official result.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, like, why are we trying to change?
He was rolling.
I get why we're trying.
He's going fast.
Yeah, he was. But like, as far as the whole caution system in itself, like, I get why we're trying to change it, but we're trying to reinvent the wheel on a system that every single rider that's 70 years old right now to little Johnny that just learned how to ride a motorcycle today at 3 years old, when they get to their first race, we've learned since day one, heed a caution flag, heed a yellow flag. And maybe a simpler solution is go back to yellows and only pull a red cross when it is absolutely freaking necessary, where it's either a red cross flag or we shut the whole damn thing down. But pulling a red cross
flag. I don't think that's think acting with rider safety in mind, because so we only put, we're under yellow unless something's really, really, really bad. No, that is.
Well, I mean, that's how amateur racing works though.
100%. No. But yeah, like, I don't know.
There's just so much. It would go a long way if whether it's Mike Pelletier with the AMA or whoever else, you know, I mean, Yogi's in there. That's part of these discussions now, whoever's part of the rules and safety protocol board or whatever between right now and A1 2027, take an hour a week and go through the entire thing and make this black and white. And if it takes more money as an investment at the races to do this, then you got to do it. I have heard that, you know, SMX signed a $40 million deal with Peacock. You can't tell me 1% of that $40 million can't be put aside in the name of safety with either a different lighting system or more flaggers, something. You can't tell me $400,000 can't be put aside to change it and make safety more black and white, make the rule book more black and white, to where there shouldn't be any up to the promoter discretion. That phrase should be nowhere in the rule book anymore. Absolutely not.
Yeah. And unfortunately there is a lot of that, and they'll likely continue to be a lot of it. At first, after all we had to talk about with the 450 class, I'm like, is there really all that many storylines to kind of dive into with the 250s? But, I'll just hold my tongue. Cause yeah, I, Kyle, I need to get your thoughts on a few of these results. Where do you want to start? Bottom of the page with Jalik Swole, unfortunately, or, on the podium for one of those early round podiums that he's known for, Daxton Bennick.
You know, it's something compared to the last 2 years with Dax, you know, at least, well, his rookie year, that podium kind of lucked into it. Tampa last year, obviously he gets a little bit of a break there with a red flag restart with Pierce Brown going down and them having to stop the race. That one in Dallas the other night, he absolutely earned that.
He earned every single piece of that.
Did he get some slight help with Cole Davies being a pinball in corner one? Absolutely. But he got the start that he needed, and he rode to a solid third place. That was the most convincing podium that he's had since he's only got three of them. But out of the three, that's the most convincing podium that he's had in his career. And I like Dax. Like, I've known Dax since he was a little dude on 65s, and he's a good kid. And I know he tries. He's just, whether it's a mental thing or just whatever it is, plus he's been hurt quite a bit, but he hasn't put it together, and he hasn't put it together for more than half a season. But that was a definite sign of things to come. And that whole Rockstar Energy Husqvarna team has really stepped up this year with Ryder D and Dax. And I really hate that Casey is hurt again. I mean, that's the third year in a row that he's hurt before he gets anything going. And it just bums me out for him, because I think he was in a good spot entering East this year to make a splash. Hopefully he's back in a few weeks and can, you know, put it in the mains, because he still hasn't raced a Supercross yet. Casey hasn't raced one Supercross yet. But, you know, Dax absolutely rode into that third. If he gets two more podiums this year, I'd say that's a good year. And I think Daytona this weekend, I think Daytona would be a good place for him to get another podium.
Yeah, he could absolutely do it. I've honestly, the 250 East class, I'm all about it. This is not the one horse race that we've seen over on the West Coast, but we leave the first round in Dallas, with a couple of question marks. Is Pierce Brown for real? And how for real is Cole Davies? Because he was on the ground on the first lap, all the way to fifth. Like, at one point, I think he was outside the top 10 with like maybe 8 minutes to go. And he just put his head down and was, I think he was fastest on track a number of times.
He didn't have the fastest lap of the night. That went to Pierce, but consistently through the whole race, Cole was absolutely fastest, but it wasn't in such, you know, vast amounts once he got inside that top 10. I think he got inside that top 10 with, you know, over halfway left, but he had such a gap to whoever finished ahead of him. He wasn't going to make that up with, you know, 6-7 minutes left. It just wasn't going to happen. But Pierce, as far as he's concerned, like, I was in Tampa that last year for that race. That was one of the most massive crashes I've seen. And
yeah, he yard sailed.
I can't believe it's one thing that he's even back at all. Like, the fact that he's even back, I mean, that's a burst fracture. It's one thing if you fracture a vertebrae. It's another thing when that fracture is a burst type fracture. There are guys that do not come back from it. There are guys that do not walk from a fracture like that ever again. And the fact that he is back to where he is, and I think his career would have gone a completely different direction. I feel like when KTM brought him in, the kid had speed. He's always got speed. We just saw that the other night. The kid has speed. And he has speed when they brought him in however many years ago it's been. But I don't know if he was ready to be that guy. He was very fast as an amateur. He wasn't a dominant amateur. And I just
He was part of that, like, Derek Drake Orange Brigade. Like, they had, like, 10 kids under their tent.
But how many of those guys that they brought up through the Orange Brigade program after? How many guys though ever won a race either during or after? I'm pretty sure Pierce is the first one to do it, and it took him how many years to do it? So I think they brought him along with the rest of those guys through that program over the years. They brought him up too soon. I think they should have given Pierce another year in amateurs before they brought him in. I think things would have gone different for him because he had the speed, the effort was there, but I don't think that the technical ability was there for him as far as Supercross goes. I think they should have started him in outdoors that summer, the year that they brought him in, whatever that was, 2019, I think. I think he's been around that long.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it went wrong for him for a lot of years. But to see him come back from that Tampa crash last year, and it was a fantastic ride. And he didn't really put a wheel wrong. He looked like the Pierce Brown that he was supposed to look like when he entered the pros, but I just don't think he was ready when he entered the pros.
Why? Yeah, I would love to. There's got to be some sort of like trail of breadcrumbs that leads back to like the source of why the Orange Brigade program just didn't work for so many, like the Sean Cantrells of the world. Alex Falk. Fry, sorry.
Yep.
Mitchell Falk. Is Derek Max Drake. Markov on that at all? Or no.
He
wasn't he at the very beginning of it?
He was, but he didn't even get to A class. I don't think before that all went horribly, horribly wrong for him.
Yeah.
I think that's a whole different ball of wax that I don't think a lot of people know about, and I'm not going to spill the beans on it here.
Yeah.
But that's a completely different situation from everybody else. But yeah, I know what they were trying to do with that program. I just think they brought it along faster than they probably should have to be that feeder system for what was then the Troy Lee Designs KTM team. Because it was supposed to feed right into
yeah, that like program. That was sort of supposed to be the like guys kind of stepping off of that program. I still think they moved a couple of those guys up a little early, and for whatever reason they were often hurt. I don't understand like a lot of those guys had injury problems, but obviously like it's a dangerous sport. A lot of riders have injury problems, or in teams who have riders that get injured on it, like it's Pro Circuit is a team that like they talk about curses and stuff like that. It's not, it can't be. Like their Mitch's bikes are some of the most reliable and most potent race machines North America. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? But yeah, that program, that Orange Brigade program, for whatever reason, whether it's Derek Drake or, like you said, Mitchell Falk, there seem to be like a weird amount of like almost an entire wave just got fumbled somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, like I said, I mean, the intention was there. The intention was good. I think the speed at which they did it was rushed.
Wasn't Thrasher part of that at the very end too?
So Thrasher was on that program when he ran B class at Loretta's.
Okay.
And then if you remember, when the TLD program, because he was under TLD, it was Orange Brigade TLD.
Right.
When that program went to GasGas, that null and voided his contract because they technically switched brands, even though they were under the same umbrella group, obviously.
Right.
And his agent,
you changed the contract.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. His agent caught that and said, "Hey, you broke contract. We're free to go where we want to." And
right.
He went to Star, and it's been history since. Yeah.
Right. That's right. Huh. And like, well, I guess with the one guy we didn't even mention, although he's landed on his feet, but, like, I don't know that Max Vollen's career has been handled great. Like, there's just been a lot of injuries, but like, is there any management, like, or like mismanaged?
Like, no, I think Max went in too early, but KTM's hands were kind of tied because they lost their guys and didn't have anybody. So they brought Max up sooner than what they probably should have, but
yeah, I think their hands were kind of tied there. Talent is one of the smartest people in the industry.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I have so much respect for him.
He was smart in the sense that when they approached him about Max moving up earlier, you know, the year earlier or 2 years earlier than what he probably should, Talon was smart and said, "All right, you're going to give us a 3-year deal then. If you're going to bank on us to be your guy, then you need to make it a longer term than just
you need to commit to his two and done." And that was big. Still think, and I think he kind of, like, people sort of forget that they wanted to do the Europe route. They wanted to do I think it was the EMX 125, EMX 250. And I think that's when COVID hit, is when they had to come back, or maybe he hurt himself.
No, they were over there and had to come back before everything got shut down.
That's right.
Where they couldn't travel back. Yeah.
That's right.
Because, I mean, we all remember watching him ride that KTM free ride when he was still on mini bikes and stuff. I mean, he's got such good style on a motorcycle.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's absolutely,
he'll win a race
killer
this year. I guarantee it. I don't even guarantee it. I say he wins a race this year.
And the fact that he's doing it essentially with one foot.
He will stand incredible on one leg and win a race this year. I hate to talk about it. But another tough start to a series for Jalyk Swole.
I don't even know at this point. And Jalyk is one of the he's one of the nicest kids on the series. He absolutely puts 110% in. Like, that kid does not cut anybody short on effort. But God, I wish that Black Cloud would just leave him for more than 3 races. Like, he can't hardly go. And I mean, and he didn't even get to race Supercross last year because of the Achilles. The fact that he ran as well as he did outdoors last year was unbelievable. Because, I mean, who comes back that soon from an Achilles and does as well as he did? But then can't even get through the first main and crashing, knocking yourself silly. I don't think he was unconscious, but he definitely rung his bell pretty well. And yeah, I just, if he's able to race this weekend, since it's more of a, since it's an outdoor style track, I look for him to be better on that type of track, despite the fact that he's gotten podiums in stadiums before, but he's also won an outdoor moto. So I look at that aspect of it as well. And if he's 100% going into Daytona this weekend, I'd say that's where he really kind of stamps his mark on this series. I mean, he's out of it for the title essentially, but leave a lasting impression at Daytona.
Is there a pair of teammates that would have more like different injury stories to talk about than Jalik Swole and Austin Forkner?
Maybe going back 20, 25 years to pro circuit with like a Shea Bentley and a Bobby Bonds.
Okay. Yeah. Those guys both had like fictional shoulders. So that makes sense. Yeah. Those guys literally just arms popped off like a Ken doll, but like, I hate to, I'm not poking fun at it. I think that, like, these two have absolutely been through it physically. And both of them have come back swinging, by the way. I hope that, Jalik's able to, like he's a Floridian.
We were also supposed to have Forkner for this series and we don't have him.
And we don't have him. But yeah, those two could swap some stories, I reckon.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But, so night for Drew Adams. Like I would have expected, him to be more in the fight. I think he probably would say so the same, but, this is his rookie year in Supercross, correct?
No, he ran two last year. He had a collarbone injury right off the bat.
Right. But this I consider, like, what I mean by that is I consider this.
If he can make it past this weekend, yes.
Yeah.
But Drew's going to struggle unless Mitch can figure out a way to make that 250 a bomb to actually get him a top five start. Otherwise, Drew's going to struggle all this year because he's such a tall guy and that guy is not the fastest bike anymore like it was when they were the only four stroke back in the day, or even when the four strokes came with Yamaha and Honda and
EFIs,
right. I mean, Mitch doesn't have the fastest bike anymore, and Drew is the biggest guy in that series. You know, I mean, he and Colin Park are the two tallest guys.
Bro, when they were battling,
15, 20 pounds on him.
When they were battling, I was like, it's just legs and elbows. Colin Park and like literally, dude, like that's two super tall guys on a dirt bike. Both of them, their knees are above the seat. I don't know if either one of them go with like a taller seat. But yeah, like Colin Park, he's got to be what, 6'5"? And every time I see Drew Adams, he seems to grow another inch. So he must be similar to your average point guard nowadays, but wow. Yeah. They're both super tall.
Yeah. And I think Colin got off the gate better than Drew did the other night. And I think Drew's got about 15 pounds on Colin, and that absolutely makes a difference in the 250 class. But like I said, if Mitch can't figure out a way to build a time bomb for Drew to at least get him off the gate,
yeah,
it's going to be a struggle for him. Drew, if Drew can get a top five start this weekend, that's going to be his shot because it's an outdoor style track. Drew is better, I feel, at outdoors, even though he's, SMX Next champion from a couple years ago. I do feel he's a better outdoor rider. So if he can get a top five start this weekend, I feel like that's his chance to get a win. Or it's going to be outdoors before we really can see what he's capable of. But I look for him to be a 450 guy just because of his height and his weight, and which just seems weird because, like you said, I mean, every time we see him, it seems like he grows another inch because it wasn't that long ago when he was winning B class when I don't know if that kid could touch the ground sitting on the motorcycle.
Yeah,
and now he's the tallest kid in the series practically. But
well, the irony is the first time that Drew Adams is on my radar was when he was not tall enough to touch on a KX450. I think it was at Ichikani, if I'm not mistaken, and he like was riding it around the track in the pit area there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember years ago, Loretta Lynn's. He couldn't really touch that well on an 85.
Yeah. And now look at him.
Right. I mean, he's a half a foot taller than me almost. And he's just, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch, but I mean, kid's tall. He's heavy. He's got to be pushing 175, I'd say.
Oh yeah. No, he's built like a Gary Bertier. Like that guy he could play middle linebacker for you. But yeah. He's still got the skills on a dirt bike. I could see him, multiple podiums this year. 250 class, who you got for this weekend in Daytona? Even if it gets a little bit, if it's mud, just go with the Shimoda, but, yeah. Who do you got? No, actually, honestly, if it's mud, it's Davies. Guaranteed that kid's good in the mud.
I look at if it's mud, I look at a dark horse in Cody Shock.
Wow, I'm going to tell him you said that.
Because the guy's just a bulldog, and he didn't get the start last weekend, but he rode well. I think if he's
now you're sucking up
there,
to him.
No, I'm really not though. Like, and I'm not saying that he's not capable of winning in a stadium, but just I feel like with his personality and his riding style, like he's able to make something happen when it's really technical and really nasty out. For how bad the ruts were in Dallas, that wasn't really a technical track. If the ruts were all straight, there weren't holes in them or anything like that. Daytona this weekend is one of those tracks that can reach up and grab you from one lap to the next.
Yeah, you got to be a technician.
Even when it's dry. And Cody's just that working class guy that's been there and done it all.
Finds a way.
Right. And so that, I mean, it's for those reasons that I think, you know, if it's something really weird, like it's a mutter, maybe not a win, but I could see a podium. Absolutely.
Fair enough. And if it's a mutter, I'm going to say Cole Davies, but in the dry, honestly, probably the same. Cole Davies looked that good in his heat race. He looks calculated. I don't know if outdoors he's more of a supercross guy than outdoor guy, right?
Well, I mean, we only got to see him, what, two outdoors last year, and one of them he gets a moto win.
Yeah, fair. So, yeah, safe to say he's just good at stuff. Actually, you know what? For the victory, I'm going to say that Pierce Brown backs up his win and gets it in Daytona. What about the 450 class? Who you got?
It's hard to bet against Eli if it's dry.
It's his house.
Yeah. If it's nasty, you got to think
Plessinger.
Webb. Yeah.
What about Plessinger?
I would love to say Aaron.
The cowboy could absolutely just go play in the mud. If it's Florida kind of wet mud.
Yeah. If it's nasty, just garbage, rainy Daytona, that place will literally set on fire if Aaron wins it.
Yeah.
If there's one race for Aaron to ever win,
let it
it's
happen.
Daytona.
Let it happen and let him take the lead in the last lap and wheelie off into the sunset.
I mean, I still remember 8 years ago just feeling the way I felt. I mean, it was a dry race, but with Justin Brayton winning his only Supercross ever, either class, he wins his only Supercross ever. Like, I remember how, like, the way I felt. That would be the same thing if Plessinger could win Daytona. He's won two of them before, obviously, but if that guy could win Daytona when it's nasty out,
that's just like
Speedway will burn to the ground.
The event he's supposed to win. Awesome, man. Well, I always appreciate you making some time for the Big MX Radio podcast. Where can people follow along more with what you got going on?
Yeah, just follow along mostly on Instagram at Wolf Creative Co. And that's Wolf with an E. My name does have an E at the end of it. But yeah,
put it in the description.
We're into the off-road swing now. We already did the first GNCC. I'm actually heading out in the morning here to go to the first J-Day series down here. The first J-Day round of their series it's here in Florida. And they're doing a round at Club MX here in a month. They're going to Bud's Creek and Unadilla and stuff. But Yeah, we've got Daytona Supercross this weekend and round two of the GNCC series for the bikes on Sunday at in Palatka. So it's going to be a nonstop couple of weeks for me.
Awesome, man. Well, can't wait to hear more about it, break it all down with you. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.